Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everybody. New York Times columnist and former executive editor Bill Keller is my first guest today. With Paul Ryan named as Mitt Romney's running mate, Keller took a step back this week to write about the entire package of Romney advisors likely to drive change in this country if Romney is elected president. We will also talk about Ecuador granting asylum to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, since Keller has worked with and written about Assange. Hi, Bill. Thanks very much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
First, you write that vice presidents matter, and Paul Ryan would matter more than most. Why do you think so?
Because he is the keeper of the torch on economic matters for the Republican Party. His the Ryan plan, which has gone through various iterations, being initially his own sort of roadmap, and now being the House passed budget bill, has been embraced by conservative groups, candidates, and by Romney himself. I realize that Governor Romney has been making a point of saying in the last several days that he's going to have his own plan, and I'm sure he will. But he has embraced this, and it, you know, it forces some issues onto the table that people have generally been reluctant to talk about. First and foremost among them, Medicare.
And suddenly people are talking about them this week. The heart of your column, I think, is your question about whether anything short of hyper-partisanship is possible for a Republican president in today's Washington, even one who governed as a pragmatist in Massachusetts. Do you think it might not be even up to Romney in a certain way? You seem to imply that.
I think I don't want to take this too far. Presidents obviously have power. But, you know, you look at what's happened to John Boehner in recent years. I mean, he's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. You would think a powerful position. And yet, time and time again, his efforts to move towards the other side of the aisle to construct some sort of a grand budget bargain with the White House have been stymied by his own party. I've been in and out of Washington on various reporting things since 1974, and it's not a new thought that the place feels more stuck and more dysfunctional than it ever has. But part of that is, and the reason I think that that's more true on the Republican side, is the Republicans have been very disciplined about building up this whole infrastructure of think tanks, party groups. You know, you have Grover Norquist and his Americans for Tax Reform. You have the Family Research Council on the social issues. You have, the various campaign committees. You have the Federalist Society, which polices judicial appointments for conservatives. And they've been very disciplined about constructing this this kind of ready-made entourage that a new Republican president is likely to depend upon, and it's an open question to what extent he becomes the leader of this infrastructure and to what extent it's captive. I think to some extent he is the captive of it.
Do you think he might have promised anything to Ryan in terms of specific policies that he would enact or portfolios that Ryan would have in order to get him on the ticket?
I have no idea, of course, any more than you do, what kind of conversations the two of them had.
I ask because, you know, you talk about influencing from inside or outside, and the Ryan game plan, and this was written up in great detail by Ryan Lizzen, the New Yorker, a few weeks ago, who predicted that Ryan would not join the ticket, partly because Ryan was so effective doing what he was doing the last few years from outside the administration, from within Congress, putting more and more and more pressure first on the mainstream Republicans in the House and through that on the Obama administration by, you know, organizing and ratcheting up the pressure from that wing of the conservative, from that conservative wing of the Republican Party from the House.
That may well be true, and it looked at as a sort of objective and theoretical proposition that he could have been, you know, the go-to guy on Capitol Hill and the one who rallied the forces and got the votes together and stuff. But you know, the one thing that emerges in every profile I've read of of Paul Ryan, including Ryan Liz's excellent piece in The New Yorker, is his ambition. You know, the whole trope about how his father died when he was 15, and ever since then it's been, you know, there's just not going to be enough time to get it all done. I can't stop. I got to keep moving. And, you know, I find it hard to believe that Romney had to sell Paul Ryan on the idea of prospectively being vice president. I mean, first of all, this gives him the biggest platform he's ever had for talking about his ideas, and he loves to talk about them. He's not one of those guys who kind of issues position papers and then lets them speak for themselves.
Yeah, but I wonder about that, because vice presidents don't necessarily get that big platform, certainly not an independent platform. If anything, they have to shut up if they think their president is not going far enough.
Right, but he hasn't shut up yet in the campaign, and he may. It's, I mean, another thing that's disciplined about the Republican Party is their campaign operations, and he may suddenly find that a lot of things he'd like to say get scratched out by the people the advanced people who vet speeches for him. But I think in his mind, by joining the ticket, he was making at least his principles, if not the chapter and verse of his entire plan, mm-hmm. the Republican Party plan, in a way it had not been before. Now, you know, you can talk about how useful he will be, what role he will play when he becomes vice president. That's always a kind of speculative game. Presumably they would use him on the Hill because Romney doesn't have his own experience there, but I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But this appointment, you know, what Romney was offering him was an opportunity to make his budget bill the Republican platform to a large extent in a way that it had not been before.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Bill Keller. We can take your phone calls for him on the people likely to drive change in America if Mitt Romney is elected president. And we will also get into Ecuador granting asylum and getting into a whole diplomatic kerfuffle with the UK over Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Okay, let's go down this list of other key players that you made and see what you think some of them portend. On foreign policy.
But before you do, just sure. to be clear, this was not, I'm not predicting that this will be the Romney team. Some of these are people who are clearly already influential. Some of them are people who are sort of thrust upon him as the candidate. And this was a sampler. The list could have been 50 people, but I wanted to pick a sampler of influential voices and what they say about a Romney presidency, and what they say about it is that it will likely be a very conservative presidency.
Got it. So let me start with the most astounding one. Robert Bork, as co-chair of his Justice Advisory Committee. Bork, who even George W. Bush rebuked when he was running for president in 2000 as basically being too divisive and too dark. Why Robert Bork?
Again, Romney hasn't confided in me why he made Robert Bork the co-chairman of his Justice Advisory Committee, but I assume it was because during the primary season, Romney had, more than George W. Bush did, more than most Republicans do, a need to convince the right, the Tea Party right, and the more conventional farther right of his party, that he was one of them, that he was not the blue state governor that he'd been, or even the technocrat that he seemed to be during the Olympics, but that he was a committed conservative. And nothing says conservative, nothing says right-wing judge like Robert Bork.
And you quote your colleague, Linda Greenhouse, who predicts Romney would go as far to the right on Supreme Court nominations as his base wants and Senate politics permit. But do you accept that at face value? Maybe the moderate pragmatist in Romney, who governed Massachusetts, admires the independence of what John Roberts did on health reform. And again, I realize neither of us have a way to know.
Right. Well, yeah, neither of us have a way to know. What Romney has said about the court is that he recites the names of the four conservative justices as those that he most admires: Alito, Scalia, Roberts, and Thomas.
And in fact, I've meant to go back and look at the campaign website and see if he's taken John Roberts' name off the list because he did have it in writing on the campaign website.
Yeah.
I would appoint justices like Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts. I wonder if Roberts is still on there.
I haven't checked either. I would guess that he is. I mean, you know, he's. I don't think that people are consulting the website for predictions as to what he will do as president.
But he has said that. He has articulated, he's spoken the names of the conservative wing on the court.
And they are all quite conservative. I mean, Thomas and Scalia are Scalia is the most kind of articulate spokesman for the originalist point of view.
He didn't say thoughtful independence like Anthony Kennedy or Sandra Day O'Connor. That's kind of the point.
No,
right?
He clearly did not. I mean, the interesting question, I think, with Supreme Court appointments is, does a president view them as something that's part of his legacy, or does he view them as something he can give to the base so that he can do other things he cares about more? I mean, for example, if Romney gets in and he wants to do some compromising on taxes, he allows us how he might want to raise taxes a little bit. He I can conceive of that happening. It would be hard for him to do, but I can conceive of it. He might very well decide that the Supreme Court was a place where you can throw a bone to the conservatives and essentially let the Federalist Society or Robert Bork kind of vet who you appoint. And the odds are you would get something closer to a Scalia, I think, than to a John Roberts. And certainly you wouldn't get an Anthony Kennedy.
Let's take a call. Somebody wants to chime in on this question of how much Paul Ryan will be able to speak his mind as vice president. Ken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. I just want to remind everybody about Sarah Palin and the possibility that...
specifically what?
Excuse me, that... he could just be a loose cannon like she was, and the Republican Party had a hard time muzzling her, and maybe the same thing will happen with him.
Thank you. Do you think that started to happen this week? From your observation of the campaign trail, has Ryan been already kind of off the reservation in any way? I don't have chapter and verse, but I feel like there's been a little unease around that.
I certainly don't think he's gone rogue. I can't think of anything particular that he's said that the party immediately came out and disavowed. I mean, the one area, as we discussed a little earlier, that, you know, Romney has made a point of saying it's not going to be the Ryan budget, it's going to be the Romney budget. And my plan will be my plan, not, you know, so don't take everything in his plan and assume that it's mine. But we haven't seen a Romney plan yet. Ryan continues to talk about his view of Medicare and in particular and his view of the debt crisis. I certainly have not had a sense of him going rogue. And I can't imagine the people in the campaign are wringing their hands and saying, oh, my God, what have
we done? I think it would be more subtle than going rogue. But even in the 60 Minutes joint interview with Romney and Ryan, there was a little bit of backing off by Romney on some of the stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. By the way, we just checked the campaign website. And, yes, John Roberts is still on there as one of the models that Romney would use for nominations. Let's go to somebody less known. On foreign policy, you write that Romney has so far bypassed mainstream Republicans for the neoconservative wing instead, especially a young guy named Dan Senior, who you call next generation John Bolton. Who is Dan Senior, and am I even saying his name right?
I think it's Dan Senior is the way he goes. He's a
S-E-N-O-R.
S-E-N-O-R, right. He's a 40-year-old conservative guy who first attracted attention when he was Paul Bremer's spokesman. Bremer was the American, effectively governor of Iraq after the American occupation began, and it was under his tenure, I think it was widely regarded as the worst phase of a bad occupation. It was during that time that they basically dismantled and debathified the military so that we took a relatively functional Iraqi army and turned it into an insurgency. And a lot of contracts were awarded that were subsequently questioned to foreign firms to come in and capitalize on the oil industry and so on. It was not a proud moment in American foreign policy, and Dan was Bremer's enthusiastic spokesman during that time.
You would think that after Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz and, you know, Bush record in general in that area, that the neocons would be on the run.
They are very much not on the run. I mean, you know, it's always hard to tell what happens when a president gets into office. But this is a president who, or this is a candidate who doesn't have any foreign policy experience, and is probably more than, say, a George H.W. Bush, a novice at this. And so he's going to be dependent on other people. The people he seems to be listening to are people like Dan Senor. I referred to him as the next gen John Bolton. Bolton was the American ambassador to the UN and held a position in the State Department before that, and is still writes prolifically from a neocon point of view. Dan Senor also was a co-founder of a think tank in Washington with Bill Kristol, who's quite conservative. So the tendency is very much
original neocon on foreign policy.
Yeah, David Sanger did a really good piece in the New York Times Sunday Review, I think it was in May, about the frustration of the more mainstream Republican foreign policy experts who would hope to play a role in a new administration, but so far seem to be a little more marginalized.
Bill Keller, New York Times columnist, looking forward to what a Romney administration might be like based on the people who might have influence. You do write, quote, "It's possible President Romney would prefer to convene an administration of deal cutters and problem solvers, mm-hmm. the trusted aides expected to help him organize the West Wing, former Senator Jim Talent of Missouri, Mike Leavitt, former governor of Utah, former Bain Capital partner Bob White, and Beth Myers, who was Romney's chief of staff in Massachusetts, are more managers than firebrands." Mm-hmm. So why not think this will be more of a Beth Myers presidency, if you will, rather than a Robert Bork presidency?
Because those are the people who are going to be the organizers, the resume collectors, but they're not the ones who are going to fill I think the sort of standard line is that there are 5,000 jobs that a new administration fills when it comes in. No team of experts and technocrats, no matter how eager they are to be pragmatic, can fill all those jobs on their own. You know, you immediately turn to what I referred to before as the infrastructure. You look to the think tanks, you look to the people on Capitol Hill, you look to the organizations that have supported you, and that's how you assemble. You delegate the process of selection and vetting to a lot of these other groups. So,
one could argue that some of the opposite has happened in the Obama administration. Like so much has said about how Attorney General Holder has been frustrated on detention policies and things like that. They kept Gitmo open, reversed his desire to have civilian trials for detainees, things like that. That seemed to be governed from the political and pragmatic wing of the White House.
Right. Well, as I said in the piece, the Democrats haven't got this kind of Washington discipline down nearly as well as the Republicans have. If you survey the think tanks or survey the key congressional players in Washington these days on the Democratic side, there's still a range. You know, the Democrats on the Hill go all the way from, you know, proto-socialists to blue dog, you know, proto-Republicans. The think tanks are often centrist. You know, it's hard to think of very many Republican centrists anymore. So, you know, the Democrats, aren't going to march in the same kind of lockstep as a rule.
We'll continue in a minute with Bill Keller. We'll ask him about the part of his article this week on the Mogul Chorus. We'll see what influence he thinks people like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, who won't be officially in the administration, might be able to wield from without after throwing so much money in the direction of getting Romney elected president. And we'll talk a little bit about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange being granted asylum by Ecuador, but this whole standoff between Ecuador and the UK around Assange's presence at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
¶¶
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Bill Keller, who wrote a piece this week called The Romney Package about Paul Ryan and others who might drive change in a Romney administration. 212-433-WNYC. And John in Harrington Park, you're on the air. Hi, John.
How are you?
Okay.
Listen, I don't know if anyone has made the analogy yet, but to me, Paul Ryan seems to be the Tim Tebow of the Republican ticket. I'm sure a lot of members of the press did some high fives after they found out he was the vice presidential pick. And he seemed, you know, he's more colorful, he's more sensational, perhaps better looking, too, for the media than Mitt Romney. And I just think it's rather comical.
That is a pretty interesting analogy. I usually don't like football analogies for politics, Bill, but that's a really interesting one, how Tebow is brought in as the second quarterback to Mark Sanchez for the Jets, but really he's the big star who's going to drive the way they do things and get all the attention and run naked on the field, apparently, as we saw the other day. I don't know if Paul Ryan's going to run naked anywhere, but yeah, here's the guy who's actually the driver of change in Washington right now, arguably, while Mitt Romney, nobody knew what he stood for.
Yeah, well, to some extent, he gets to be Tim Tebow because the starting quarterback is so lackluster to begin with. I mean, you know, Romney has not ignited the Republican Party base, and you know, columnists like me are endlessly writing about the mystery of who he is and what's his core and whether he has convictions. So when you get a guy who, where there's actually some there, whether you like the there or not, it's bound to draw the spotlight.
Yes,
and you know, I mean, I guess you have to give Romney credit for, you know, being willing to put somebody on the ticket who's more vibrant than he is.
And for those of you who don't know the Jets story, I guess I shouldn't have said naked, but rather half naked. It was shirtless that Tebow did his little streak there. I didn't know Christians were allowed to do that. I don't know. But anyway, one section of your article is called The Mogul Course, about the huge conservative donors and spenders from within or without the campaign, like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and Bob Perry of the famous Swift Boat slander against John Kerry. People like this won't be in his cabinet. What's their path to influence?
Their path to influence has been money and more money. And you know, there have always been campaign donors who expected to be rewarded in one way or another. And the traditional euphemism is that, you know, you can't actually buy influence, but you can buy access. You get the, it buys you a ticket into the office to make your case. I've never thought that was entirely true, but now we're in a whole different world. I mean, thanks to Citizens United, these guys are able to donate tens of millions of dollars, and they are able to shift the course of a campaign. It's not just a donation; it's an investment in the candidate. And so you have, you know, Sheldon Adelson, who is the casino mogul and also a great ardent champion of Israel. You have the Koch brothers, who are petroleum and conglomerates that have all sorts of other industrial interests, and you have Bob Perry, the home builder from Texas, who was also the bankroller of the Swift Boat effort against John Kerry. What all of these people have in common, above all, is just a loathing for any kind of regulation. And you know, I find it hard to believe that if they don't abolish the Department of Energy or the Department of the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Commerce, nobody's going to become Secretary of Commerce or Secretary of Energy or Director of the EPA who doesn't pass muster with these big donors. I think they have, nobody will ever say it, but they have an effective veto over candidates for a lot of the key regulatory jobs. And the guys who get those jobs are going to take their phone calls.
I see Barbara and Seacliff called in but didn't want to hang on to say more Bush-Cheney than Sanchez-Tebow. Cheney as the puppeteer. So Ryan as the puppeteer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Cheney had the generational sort of fatherly claim and a lot more experience in the executive branch of government than Paul Ryan.
So here's a different take on the eight. You talk about the father figure. Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I just want to say say, first of all, that I adore your column, Mr. Keller, and it's always insightful and thought-provoking.
Oh, thank you.
No, really, I read it every time I can. I just want you to discuss the division that this ticket brings. We certainly have two white guys and their philosophy in terms of racism, and we have classism, but also I'd like you to speak to the issue of ageism, that there's no question that Ryan was put up not only because he's young, but he speaks to the young voter who don't want to contribute to older people in terms of Social Security and Medicare and any other benefits.
Huh, interesting. Do you think, I haven't considered this question at all. It's really interesting. Do you think that there is an attempt at a demographic appeal to younger voters in general, because Ryan's 42 and he looks young, and to Susan's point specifically, that they're trying to gin up intergenerational resentment among younger voters toward the baby boomers who would need all that Social Security and Medicare?
I hadn't thought about that before either in quite those terms. Although one caveat you would have to throw in immediately is that Ryan has very carefully constructed his Medicare proposal so that it doesn't touch anybody who's 55 or over. So he's, in a funny way, he's a young guy who's pandering to the greatest generation and the early boomers.
Yes, but
by holding them harmless and sticking it to his own generation.
Yeah, although I actually heard a caller to a conservative show this week who said, "Hey, I'm under 55 and I'm going to get stuck." It was pro Romney. "I'm going to get stuck with this new deficient Medicare because Romney and Ryan are pandering to the baby boomers." And, well, I guess that's kind of what you were saying. But
yeah. But
it's, I don't know, I guess it starts these general questions, these generational questions going in various directions.
Yeah. And once you get into those questions, you know, whatever you say, you are going to be pummeled, I can assure you. I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago on boomers and entitlements, and I don't think I've ever had quite so much angry mail, both from aggrieved boomers who were upset that I was kind of characterizing that generation, which is my generation, as a bit entitled, and from, of course, from people who I was advocating that liberals and Democrats should pay attention to entitlements as a crisis that needs to be resolved.
Right.
And, you know, the minute you step on, there's a reason they call that the third rail.
I read that column. We should have you back and have that conversation with the callers one day.
Okay.
Bill Keller, New York Times columnist. Before you go, we have a few minutes left. I want to get your take on Ecuador giving political asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And I ask Bill Keller, folks, because he has talked to and written about the Times' work with Assange on some of the materials that Assange had to release early on. But full disclosure, you've been critical of Assange in various ways, and he seems to hate you. Do you see WikiLeaks as a news organization in a way like the New York Times, releasing documents in the public interest that the government tries to conceal?
Well, I think somebody who works for the New York Times should be a little humble about deciding who else gets to be called a news organization. What I have said about the criticism of Julian Assange and the potential that he could be prosecuted in the U.S. is that if the U.S. government prosecutes WikiLeaks or Julian Assange under the Espionage Act, as has been hinted that they might, that I would think an awful lot of my peers and colleagues in the media would leap to his defense, because that would be an assault on all of us. Because what he has done is, although he does it in a very different way and he strikes a different pose and he has a different agenda, what he basically does is acquire information and publish it. That if you can criminalize somebody for publishing secrets, that's as opposed to leaking secrets. If you can criminalize somebody for publishing secrets, then the First Amendment starts to look pretty pitiful.
So Assange is currently holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Do you say Ecuadorian or Ecuadorian? But in London. And yesterday, Ecuador decided to grant him full asylum. The problem is Britain won't allow safe passage from the embassy to the airport without arresting Assange, who's wanted in Sweden for questioning in a sexual assault case. Now, help our listeners unpack this. First, it's hard for many people to believe that Assange is really only going to face personal behavior issues in Sweden if he gives himself up, that it would then become about the United States charging him with espionage in connection with WikiLeaks, and he would be extradited here. How much do you buy that scenario?
Somewhat, but not entirely. I mean, you have to sort of preface everything that involves Julian with the fact that, you know, that he is at the center of a drama and enjoys being at the center of a drama. He's become a kind of cult figure for challenging the U.S., and nothing he can do will drive away his true believers. It was really interesting looking at the comments posted on, there were hundreds and hundreds of comments posted on the news story on the Times website about him getting the asylum, and an awful lot of them were, you know, of course, Ecuador stood up to the United States. Bravo, Ecuador! Because there's a conspiracy to spirit him away to Guantanamo or put him before a military tribunal and have him executed. I mean, at the moment, his immediate jeopardy is an extradition request granted by the British government from Sweden to stand trial to face two women who accuse him of sexual assault. Sweden has very strict sexual assault laws. They also have a pretty functional democracy. But Julian has refused to abide by that order to go to Sweden because he says the United States will file its own extradition treaty, bring him back, try him under the Espionage Act, and, you know, lock him up for life or execute him. And I think the United States is very ambivalent about Julian Assange, what they want to do with him. There clearly are people who are infuriated by the WikiLeaks, data dumps, the leak of all, especially the State Department cables, which were quite embarrassing to the United States. And they would like to hold him responsible, but they can't figure out a way to hold him responsible that wouldn't also apply to the New York Times and other organizations that published this material, because that's what he did. I think they would like it to go away. If they did extradite him, Sweden does have an extradition treaty with the United States, so if they could, they would make their case. He would be extradited. And if they tried him under the Espionage Act, which, as I've said, I think would be wrong, he would not be tried in a military tribunal. He'd be tried in a civil court. A lot of people question whether he could get a fair trial.
That's where it stands. But why do you think Ecuador is willing to get into this diplomatic showdown with the UK over Assange, or stand up to the United States, if you want to interpret it that way? They stand to be punished politically and economically for doing so. Does Ecuador have a dog in the WikiLeaks fight?
Well, Ecuador's president has a little bit of a dog in the fight. One of the odder things that Julian Assange did during his exile in England was sign up to do a talk show for Russia Today, which is the English language television network controlled by the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin, who you would think a professed champion of a free press.
I was just going to say that icon of free speech. See Pussy Riot verdict early this morning.
Yes, exactly. And President Correa of Ecuador was invited as a guest on Julian's talk show. The two of them hit it off extremely well. They both enjoy poking sticks in the eye of Uncle Sam. And that's really what it's a kind of comradely gesture from a fellow provocateur. Ecuador itself doesn't have the most sterling record of free press. Julian has found himself with some odd bedfellows in his attempt to get out of this mess.
We will see what happens. Last thing, you and Assange seem now forever tied at the hip as almost cartoon enemies, if you don't mind me putting it that way. I Googled Bill Keller, Julian Assange, NYT this morning, and got a list of links with headlines like Julian Assange blasts New York Times and Bill Keller in Rolling Stone. Bill Keller eagerly reminds you that he still hates Julian Assange, delicately put that way by Gawker. And New York Times editor Bill Keller, Julian Assange stinks, Vanity Fair. What's all that about from your vantage point in our last minute?
Well, I don't hate Julian Assange. I don't regard him as a kindred spirit particularly, but he was a source of some very, very valuable information, which I think we made excellent journalistic use of. You know, we had disagreements along the way, the most potent of which was we urged him very strongly to redact the names of innocent informants, human rights activists and so on, who appeared in the State Department cables. And he, after saying he would, ended up not doing that. And we thought that put lives at risk. He thought that we did not... he hated a profile we did of him when he became a part of the story and not just a source of the story. He thought the article in question talked about dissent within WikiLeaks. A lot of people who have left WikiLeaks because of his rather authoritarian management style. I don't hate Julian Assange. I don't even know him. We've talked on the phone a few times, but we've never even met.
Bill Keller, New York Times columnist, his piece this week about what a Romney administration might look like called the Romney Package. Thank you so much. I really appreciate all this time.
Sure. A pleasure, Brian.